response to the staring. He folded his hands and sat forward stiffly. "It's possible. It's completely possible," he said. "Completely." Chapter 24. The next Thursday, April 30th, Evan found herself sitting alone in the Mercedes on the top floor of the Temple parking garage. The car was within sight of the glass vestibule housing the ruined elevator, and she'd watched as the doors wobbled open and Robbie had joined Walter Wunsch. After a few words of hearty greeting, they passed completely out of range of the infrared while the elevator groaned and rattled as it made its descent. She sat there, unknowing, isolated, hoping like hell it didn't go to fudge, and feeling an unexpected irritation in her bladder. Following a few days of confused debate, the best tactical option seemed to be to proceed with another payment to Walter in gratitude for the favorable ruling in Drydeck. It would put to the test Sennett's theory that Wunsch was somehow on alert. No matter how loyal he was to Malatesta, Walter was not going to buy more time in the pen by accepting a second envelope. Even before the elevator had arrived back on 5, Evan knew something was wrong. The sea rush of static in her earpiece began to yield to voices. Instead of having hightailed it on the first floor, Walter was still with Robbie. They were talking about a woman with the usual unpleasant undercurrent. Favor was laughing in his humoring fashion, and Wunsch was growling in a low way that made his words difficult to discern. The elevator doors, engraved with rusty gang signs and markered graffiti, slowly parted. Unharmed, Favor stepped forth, smiling, still in the company of Wunsch. In spite of a heavy topcoat in the mild spring weather, Walter's narrow shoulders were hunched, almost up to his ears. "Not possible," she heard Robbie say. He tossed a wave at Wunsch and pushed off from the vestibule. Walter stood his ground. He stared through the smeared plate glass toward Evan in the car, his complexion like a bowl of oatmeal, his look ugly as it loitered on her. Unexpectedly, she heard Favor speaking to her over the infrared as he advanced on the Mercedes. "Okay, now when I get into the car, I'm going to say something to you, blah, 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 and I want you to laugh out loud, hysterical laugh, okay? I just told you something that's a living fucking riot." Favor bounced into the driver's seat and, as he'd said, mouthed several sentences, making no sound whatsoever, a pantomime intended for Walter. "Laugh!" he then exclaimed through his teeth. She did it. While he continued offering stage direction, his hand was lifted to obscure the movement of his lips as he told her to shake her head, laugh so hard she was coughing. Eventually, Robbie turned to the windshield and mushed up his face. He shrugged at Walter, and Walter shrugged in response. The elevator car had opened behind Wunsch, and he turned for it. She waited for a hand sign, something. But Favor gave no explanation. Instead, he rammed the car into gear and peeled from the garage. Several blocks down, he veered into an alley, bucketing along until he'd pulled into the graveled parking lot behind a small store. Its back doors were protected by a rusted security grate. Robbie pointed emphatically to his belt line and mouthed, "Off." She did not have the remote today. They were only a few blocks from the Le Sueur, and she had figured to deactivate the Foxbite at McManus's. "Shit," said Favor out loud. "Frisk," he told her. She asked what was going on. "God damn it, Frisk," he answered. He sat through it stiffly, looking off through the window. He told her to state her findings and the time, and then, without another word, plucked the microphone bud out of his shirt and tore it from the lead.
"Showtime's over," Robbie said.
"He didn't take the money?"
"Ate every bite, same as always."
At Klecker's advice, Favor had bought custom-made boots as a safer and more comfortable spot to hide the fox bite, and he jacked up his calf now to wrestle one off. He had considerable difficulty in the cramped confines of the car. She asked repeatedly what was wrong, but he refused to answer. Finally, he tore the fox bite from the ankle harness and slapped it down on her purse.
"For God's sake, what's the problem?"
"The problem is," he said, "as Walter and I are about to go our separate ways, he tells me a story. It's half a joke to him, half maybe not. Apparently, when we were in Malatesta's courtroom last week, you plowed into some guy? Well, he's a copper. Old chum of Walter's from when they were both around felony court. This guy's got a lawsuit going, administrative appeal from a ruling of the Fire and Police Board. He caught 30 days for something. Name is Martin Carmody." Faber stared, waiting for a response. "Want to buy a vowel?"
"I've seen him around. I thought I had."
"Yeah, well..." She followed Robbie's eyes as he looked out the window again toward the unfaced brick at the rear of the low building. A little tendril of something green twisted around the rusted rain pipe. "He says about 5-6 years ago, this is what he tells Walter, he was sent to Quantico for a couple of weeks of advanced firearms instructions. Out there he gets to know his instructor, female FBI agent, Dee Dee something. Real well he got to know her one night. Biblical no. And he could swear, so he tells Walter, that this chick he plowed into, meaning you, that's her. Dee Dee. Dyed her hair. Lost the glasses. A little less country looking. But Christ, that's hard to forget. The only reason he's asking Walter is because Mrs. Carmody is attending the hearing every day, and he'd rather not have any howdy-do's." Even had her eyes closed by now. "So I did the big ho-ho," Robbie said. "FBI? Ridiculous. Let's go ask her. Walter, thank God, is too much of a prude to actually stick his nose in the car and inquire of a lady about who she might have been bopping. And of course his act is what me worry about the FBI, but he was still curious enough to come up and watch."
"Fuck," she said, when she could talk.
She had never used that word in front of him, she realized, her Mormon routine. "So, Dee Dee baby, you better tell me what we're going to do now."
"God damn."
Her mind was like a ship stuck in ice. The engine revved, but the prow couldn't break through. If Walter had taken the money, she hadn't been made. But there was no way to be sure. Her whole torso was rattling. And as always, she felt her heart being carved on by shame. It was worse somehow that it had been broadcast to the surveillance van. Everybody knew. By now, Senate was spinning like a weather vane in a tornado. They were all going to be nuts.
"So do I understand?" she asked. "He was just being cautious? Carmody? He wasn't really sure? I mean, we were drunk, Robbie. Knee-walking drunk."
She drummed her fingers.
"He's not sure. That's why he asked Walter."
"Probably. But Wally's still a little spooked. It looked like he was cooled out by the time he left, but the question is still out there." She talked mostly to herself.
"I couldn't place him. I really couldn't place him. I walked right past him."
It had to have been around 1986, because they were still building Hogan's Alley, a little town where crimes were staged for training purposes. It was the first time she'd been invited back to Quantico to teach firearms. Ancient history. Another life. A tiny, inappropriate burp of laughter jumped up to her throat. Naturally, she remembered him as so much better looking.
"Yeah," he said. "A one-nighter, just a stray dick at closing time. I've been there."
When she caught Robbie's look, she understood the rest. The emotions tumbled through his dark face. He was gripping the walnut wheel with both hands, and the deep eyes flicked up at her the same way they had the first day when she told him they'd already caught a bad guy.
"Robbie," she said, then stopped.
He gunned the car, backing into the alley.
"Great cover," he told her. May. Chapter 25. Do you remember? She asked. We talked that night after Kosik. Do you remember that? And you described lying in the dark and feeling so uncertain. Do you remember? She heard the hollow glottal echo as he drank.
So are you saying?
I'll tell you what I'm saying, she said. But answer me first. Do you remember that?
Sure.
Well, here's what I need to know. Was that a play? He made a low sound, perhaps a groan. Nope, he said at last. That was straight shit. So then can you imagine reaching inside yourself and being uncertain about what's there? Not being sure you can really feel what you crave? Can you imagine that? In the dark, he took his time to ponder. After he'd removed the fox bite and told her what Walter had said about Carmody, they had driven around before heading back to the Lesueur. Contempt bristled off him. Him, of all people, enraged because he thought he'd been deceived. But his anger proved strangely hard to bear. She felt lost and mangled as it was, still trying to calculate the costs of this breach of cover to the project and to herself. Shocked that out of nowhere her former life had come like some unwelcome relation to reclaim her. If favor had dropped her on a corner, she could never have wandered home. He'd finally asked her what was true. Was she or wasn't she? She refused at first to answer. We're not going there, Robbie. It's not appropriate. I have a job to do.
And you fucked that up, too.
As the dust from the wrecking ball rose, she received a darting sideward look, softer than anything she'd seen since they left Walter. Not fair, he said after a moment, and reverted to silence. Somehow they'd reached a consensus not to remain at the Lesueur. Favor circled the block while she tossed the fox bite to McManus from the door to his office. Jim didn't say much. He wanted to know if Walter had looked sold when he'd turned back to the elevator. She thought so. So did Favor. But, she'd realized, even if Walter had doubts, there were no odds for him in confronting her. She asked if Sennett had gone crazy. Yes, Jim answered. He thinks the movers should have picked this up on background. Grave as the situation was, he smiled at the notion of that questionnaire. List every wild and crazy evening for the last 10 years. He nodded kindly when she told him she just wanted to beat it. This isn't on you, he told her. She knew that was true. It was nothing more than wicked coincidence. UCAs got made most often by cops or prosecutors who recognized them. But that was logic. If the project cratered now, it would always follow her. Back to Iowa and whatever might come next. Don't embarrass the Bureau. The Quantico watchword was burned like a brand onto the mind of every recruit. McManus and Sennett were talking anyway. Balancing risks. That was why he was just as happy to let her go. They didn't know yet what they were going to do with her. Back in the Mercedes, Favor had asked if she needed a drink, which God knows she did, and he volunteered to go into a package store to get her a bottle. Until they abandoned ship, the Mormon girl shouldn't be seen buying liquor. She was not really ready to be alone, and it seemed at least a form of recompense to finally let him into her apartment. She mixed the vodka with some frozen lemonade she had in her freezer, and after they had drunk much of it in silence, impulse had welled up in her, almost like the piston push of sickness. She wanted to explain.
Why?
She asked herself, hoping to find a clear rationale for restraint.
Why?
Because. Because silence would be fatal to something fragile in her. Because it seemed unbearable to have the precious truth, so hard to speak, taken for a lie. The light had disappeared. She'd never closed the drapes. Refractions of the streetlights and a neon sign across the avenue limed the room. Her eyes were closed for the most part. Robbie sat on the floor against the flowered sofa the movers had rented. In the cushions, when she lay on it at night watching TV, she could detect the trace remainders of stale cigar smoke and the gassy chemicals that had failed to remove it. Favor had taken off his suit jacket and his boots. His toes wiggled in his fancy patterned hose as he drank. But he'd gone still now while he deliberated on his answer.
Could he imagine?
Yes, he said in time. He could imagine that, yes. Is that how it is for you? He asked her.
How it was, she said, for years. Years.
I thought I was just not interested or didn't care. I wasn't sure. Maybe I was putting all of it into sports.
Athletes were their bodies. After a game, there was a supersensory awareness, the bruises, pulls, the aches within. Her skin felt as if something keen had been drilled through every follicle into the deeper layers of the derma. For most of her teammates, that electricity must have flowed into sexual expression, but for her, the game was the excitement. Her in-coat sensations of herself seemed almost superstitiously forbidden. Not merely because of the church-taught sense of plague or peril, but because it would deplete her somehow, put at risk the radioactive core of passion that sent her storming down the field. In high school, she was the great jock, too much for many boys to want to take on. And it was a Mormon town, anyway. More than half the kids weren't allowed to date until they were 16. She wanted to go out, naturally, once all that swung into motion. She wanted to belong. She was 17 years old. She went to the senior prom and had sex that night as if it were part of the same ceremony, which for many in Kaskia it was. She lay out in the grass on the lee side of the local ski mountain and let Russell Hugel wrestle off her undergarments and plunge into her. It didn't last a minute. He helped her up. He carefully plucked every leaf and grass strand from her dress, then walked her back down the hill in silence. The poor boy was probably embarrassed, probably thought he'd made a hash of it. A rooster in the barnyard, flapping his useless wings, went at it longer than Russell had. Such was sex. She reviewed it in her mind periodically. The interlude passed like the dance itself, long anticipated and brief and disappointing. She put away the dress and concluded as she went off to college, it was all too much of a mess. Gay. The thought that there was anyone on earth like that was still kind of a legend, as far as she was concerned, one of those terrible things that people tell you about the world that you suspect is exaggerated or not even true. She sounded like a hick, she knew, but she'd grown up on a ranch. Rams with ewes, bulls with cows. She'd heard about Sodom in church, but God had destroyed them. I made it through hockey camp the first summer with no clue, and some of those girls were so dykey, so out, one of them, Anne Marie. The girls joked about not being alone with her. I still didn't get it. She had a teammate at the time, she told him, a woman named Hillary Beacom. A good midfielder, but not quite a star. 2 years ahead of even, Hillary was from the main line near Philadelphia. Field hockey, weirdly, had a high-class heritage. There were all these women out there, running, wailing at balls, smashing each other in the legs and, even now and then, the head. Blood flowed often. It wasn't what even thought of as a finishing school game, but that's where many of the girls came from. Private schools, rich schools. Hillary Beacom had emerged from that world, blonde hair thick as velvet, pulled back in a tartan headband, clothing by Laura Ashley, and the contented charm of someone who truly owned the world. She looked after Even, sat beside her on the bus,
told her secrets about the coaches. Away from the field, they rode horseback together. One night in May of even sophomore year, they got drunk. Drinking was forbidden, in or out of season. They'd all signed pledges. But Hillary was graduating soon, and they drank wildly, rolling through half a dozen frat parties before they made their way to Hillary's room. They were just silly. They were imitating people on childhood TV shows. "Oh, Mr. Grant!" And then Star Trek stuff, all the different species who were human except for a single trait that had been amplified or mutated or replaced. Spock, without emotion.
"I see your aura," said Hillary across the room,
pretending to be a character from the Canis galaxy, who supposedly had the ability of dogs to see the halo of emotional discharge around a human being.
"I see your aura," she said, and waved her hands swami-like as she approached.
Even had collapsed on Hillary's bed with her head against a bolster. They were both laughing.
"And what do you see?"
Hillary came closer, spreading her opened palms over Even's head, as if massaging some presence in the air.
"I see," said Hillary, whose eyes seemed to clear briefly. "I see you're drunk."
They crumbled against each other. Hillary finally righted herself and began the same routine.
"I see you are uncertain," she said,
her eyes lit upon Even.
"I see you are afraid."
"Okay," said Even, laughing, though she realized then that the time for laughter had passed. Hillary moved her hands again, first around Even's head, and then allowed them to drift along her entire torso, separated from contact by some barely visible micrometer.
"I feel yearning," Hillary said.
Even didn't answer. Hillary's face, thick with makeup to hide the blemishes on one cheek, was inches from hers. The shades on the room were drawn.
"Do you know what's happening here?" Hillary asked her.
Yes, she knew. She knew, somehow. They watched each other, measuring the uncertainty. And then Hillary brought her face to hers. Even lingered there in the sweet, powerful smells of Hillary's face. Beyond the phony scents, her flesh had the vague sweetness of milk. Even's eyes were still open when their lips met. Dry from sport and the anxiousness of the moment, they felt like the fragile crust formed on an orange section left in the air, and, like the orange, some thrilling sweetness lay below. Hillary slowly brought her full weight down upon her. Favor spoke.
"So, she knew."
"No. It was something that happened. I didn't know what it meant." She never failed to admit there was pleasure in it, but afterwards she told herself she had not known what else to do. It was, oddly, not much different than being on that hillside with Russell. She remained aloof from Hillary, whose patrician grace, more than that, her kindness, prevented her from ever speaking a word. A month later, Hillary graduated. The event receded with time, its contours lost in the murk of memory. There were lots of things about her, Even reasoned, that weren't the same as most people she knew. She came from a tiny little town nobody'd ever heard of. She'd been selected for the national team in an Olympic sport, and she once slept with a girl. That was how she was. But did that mean she wasn't going to get the happiness everybody else wanted? That she wasn't entitled to it? If you'd asked her, then, after Hillary, she'd still have predicted she was going to get married, have kids, the house, the husband, a good guy, quiet and sincere, the way she thought of her father and her little brothers. When that happened, Hillary wouldn't matter. None of it would. She was 34 years old now. 34, and the vision of that waiting serenity still swam through her as a comfort from time to time, and when she realized it was never going to occur, she was still, at 34, crushed. A little more than 3 years ago, she had been detailed to San Francisco on an investigation of suspected bribery of Agriculture Department inspectors at the seaport. Another agent had taken her to this strip club for a laugh. One of the girls there was a source of his. She bounced around with a lot of would-be wise guys and had some good information. But Evan wasn't laughing. He thought it was because she was uptight and they left after a drink. But what seized up everything in her was the way one woman looked at her while she was dancing. She had her naked breasts in her hands, massaging them, drawing them together, the nipples slender, very red, and visibly erect, and she turned a yearning, willing, knowing look on Evan. It was a come-on, she realized, part of their routine. The girls played to everybody in the crowd, knowing nobody was there by accident. Everybody came looking for a little thrill. And Evan got hers. She went home and did not sleep all night. When she poured a vodka for herself, her hand shook so that she could barely get the liquid in the glass. She sat in an easy chair in the little monthly studio where the bureau'd put her and tried to calm down. And after an hour or so of drinking, she finally said it to herself. So that's how I am. And I went back. I didn't have the remotest idea what I'd say if anybody I knew showed up there. I expected to find you. I guess that was what I'd worked out in my head. I went back like it was business, an investigation. I sat in the front row. I watched this woman. Teresa Galindo, it turned out, was her name. I watched Teresa. I smiled at her. She looked at me again that way. And now I just sort of gave in, succumbed. I felt my body rise to her. Even now, the memory was stunning. Stunning. Anyway, they circulated, the girls, you know, they wanted you to buy drinks. And this girl, Teresa, she wasn't a special beauty. The girls in the clubs, most of them, the main attribute they brought to the job was that they were willing to take off their clothes and dance in front of people. Teresa was all kind of pockmarked. When she went walking around in this skinny bikini and this little bathing shift, you could see she was made up all the way down her chest. But I was so turned on, because I didn't have to work for what I wanted, because Teresa just saw it and knew what was there. When she came back with the drinks, she dropped a napkin in my lap and whispered, "I do privates." "Private what?" I nearly asked. "Dancing," is what she'd have said, but I didn't think she was really talking about dancing. I saw a phone number and just crumpled the napkin up in my hand, and I called that night so I didn't lose courage, and she came to my apartment the next morning, 11 a.m., broad daylight, before both of us went to work. It was so weird. Not because of what we were doing, and it went past dancing in about 2 minutes. Not because it was a woman's hands on me, not because of the incredible little toys she'd brought with her. There was one she called the magic wand with these three little revolving balls at the end. But because in the middle I thought, this is a dream. God, I have dreamed this. I have dreamed it 1,000 times. I paid her. And she always took the money. She said she only did this with women, and not very often, but I had no idea whether that was true. She liked me. She figured out really fast that I was law enforcement, but she never guessed it was the Bureau. She thought I was a county sheriff's deputy. She made up this whole tale about me. I worked in the jail. I hated the men in there, just the way she and most of the other girls hated the men in the club. That's why they seemed to do it. For the chance to look down on men who want it so badly, so openly, and who are not going to get it. She had her reasons, too. She'd been messed with for years by her grandfather, a big patron who everybody was afraid of. She'd been to college. That was a surprise. She had a degree in accounting, but she made more money doing this. So, anew. Out loud to myself, anew. And people who are straight, I listen to them talk, and sometimes they seem to think that knowing is the only hard part, as if straight people have an easy time hooking up with someone else and aren't miserable about the fact they can't. I tried hanging out with this woman, Teresa. Sometimes, before or after, we'd go for a drink, but she'd made up her story about me and I'd made up my story about her. Mine was that she was soft and kind and really just wanted somebody to turn to, and that wasn't so. Her crowd was tough. They liked pain. She took me to the sex clubs. They call them clubs, but it's just somebody's loft where you pay at the door. And I didn't care for what I saw. A woman with an Idaho potato? I wanted a life. That was a freak show. At least to me it was. So, she said wearily. I mean, sometimes I think about it and I'm just appalled. A stripper. A stripper, for gosh sake. It's like my life was something dreamed up by a wino in a bus station. A stripper. That was a play, Favor said. She stiffened, but she'd misunderstood. It's a rehearsal, he said. You're not bringing a stripper home to Mom. She laughed at the idea. She wasn't bringing anybody home to Mom. She'd never have the fortitude, but she knew what he meant. So where the hell does Carmody come in here? He asked. After this? Before. That was a pretty predictable period. I mean, I knew I wasn't getting the same thing from it as other people, from the act. I thought I was frightened. Well, I was frightened. So I thought if I could get drunk enough, and I was away from home. That wasn't the only time. Hardly. The mechanics, they were okay, actually. This isn't about mechanics. It's about passion. Being the kind of woman who feels passion for other women, and who wants a woman to feel passion for her. He asked who she was feeling passion for now, who she'd left back home, and somehow she laughed again at the idea. Des Moines wasn't exactly San Francisco, and she had to be sensible. There was a lot the Bureau wasn't ready for yet. Iowa City was another story, but it was a distance, and there was an uncomfortable aspect to what she encountered there, reminiscent of what she'd seen in San Francisco. A lot of those women were on a mission, and sort of demanded you be queer their way. It was fine, all right, to walk around in leather panties with your nipples covered in duct tape, but God forbid a girl liked Lee Greenwood or Travis Tritt or George Bush. Overall, though, she was still uptight. She realized that. Even now, there must have been some little part of her that was waiting for it all to go away. About 18 months ago, something started to happen with a woman from church named Tina Creant. She was married to a trooper Evan had worked with, and Tina and she had a lot of things in common, the same funny mix of hobbies, needlepoint, and pistol shooting. They did those things together. Tina liked to give her books. They laughed. She was just a warm, special person, and Evan could see something beginning. Probably the kind of thing Hillary Beacom saw in her. She never said a word, neither of them did. In retrospect, she knew she'd let it get away somehow. If she'd been bold, she might have been an example or supplied the courage for both of them. But perhaps it was just as well. Tina and Tom, her husband, had two little boys, 5 and 7. For about 2 months, Evan watched Tina work it out with herself. And decide. She quit the needlepoint circle. She stopped coming to the range. It had hurt a good deal. Even hadn't realized until then how hard she had been hoping. Sometimes now, she told him, in her worst moments, she would see one of those women who turn up in completely male settings, on road crews, or the lone white person among a Hispanic gardening gang. One of those bulky types with short hair and a dried-up face devoid of makeup and a bunched-up sweatshirt to hide what, for some reason, was always a humongous set of tits. She'd look at those women and think, Is that who I am? Is that who I'm going to be? Some self-declared misfit with her pistol collection and 3 sports channels on cable? Cut it out. He spoke unexpectedly, softly. Huh? Don't do that to yourself. I mean, you can say I don't know you, but I know that's not you. Christ, he said, you don't have it that easy. It probably wasn't funny, but she laughed for a long time, and he laughed with her. Tonight, right now, she was ready to laugh. Because he was right, both ways, the good news and the bad. She wasn't a type. She was herself. Square peg, all right. Cranky, awkward, confused, of course. But not completely ill-suited to the world. Not so dominated by these questions that they took over everything else. She had her secrets. Everybody did. Stuff swirled around inside her, undetermined, like the dust in the cosmos that wasn't yet a comet or a planet or a star. But who wasn't like that? Everybody. Everybody's sex life was strange, right? So what else do you need to know, Robbie? She asked after a time in a drier tone. Across the room she heard the ice cubes rattle in his glass. Next door, a neighbor who'd played the Bodyguard soundtrack often enough since January to wear out the plastic was at it again. How'd you come up with Even? It was the name of her first cousin, a girl about her age, an Americanized spelling meant to be pronounced the same way as Yvonne. But people got confused, the teachers, other kids. They came to call her Cousin Even, and she got tired of correcting it. At times it was a source of torment, kids being like they are. Even worse, even dumber, even uglier, even fatter. But this girl, her cousin, she had some stuff. She wouldn't dent. Even better, she would answer, and meant it. She was a doctor now in Boise, divorced, 2 kids, pretty happy on her own. They'd seen each other only once in the last 10 years, but it had been a warm occasion. Even better. She always wanted to be able to say that the way her cousin had. A motorcycle gunned by in the avenue. She asked him if there was anything else. Once and for all, he finally said, are you wired or not? She had to laugh. She'd laughed quite a bit by now. You think I'd have said all this to you with a tape recorder running? He considered that, though. He said he'd always figured they let her, as an agent, turn it on and off. She faced him in the dark. They'd been careful up to now not to look at one another. Just tell me no, he said. I believe you. Just tell me no. I've told you no before. You want to look? Huh? Look. She stood up. She lifted her arms. Go ahead and look. Go on. Frisk me. You won't believe anything else. He was startled, but he eventually padded, shoeless, and with a strangely light tread to where she waited. They don't have to do this. Yes, you do. Only don't mess around, she said. Do it the way I would. Check the purse. He stood there for some time, embarrassed or simply unskilled in laying hands on a woman without the usual involvements. Finally, he gripped her shoulders, but he went no further. Instead, he pulled her toward him slowly until her head was directly beneath his chin, and then he bent and kissed her squarely on the crown, much as he'd done in the courthouse with Leo, his elderly cousin. After that, he collected his coat and wiggled one of his feet a while, getting it back into his boot. A blade of light edged the door. You're okay, he said. Don't sound so surprised. I'll see you tomorrow. If they don't close us down tonight. He shrugged. They'd done their best, he said. Both of them. He left her in the dark, feeling he was right. The next morning, when Even left her apartment, she was followed. She took a taxi out to Glen Eyre, where she'd left her car overnight. And even as she was getting in, she saw the headlights come on in a car positioned in a no-parking zone across the street. Daylight saving had recommenced, and there was little light at this hour. She used her makeup mirror to watch behind her. The car fell back on the highway, yet it appeared now and then, and soon she noticed a second auto, sometimes floating a little ahead of the taxi in the right lane. At one point, that vehicle, a jacked-up Buick, rode alongside, its occupants black guys, older fellows with a thuggish look. The passenger had a beard and prison muscles and wore a dark do-rag and shades, even though the sun was not over the horizon. He turned to Even with a quick, knowing, smart-ass smile that froze her heart. Both cars stopped a quarter block away while she paid the taxi driver. She told Robbie as soon as she was in the Mercedes. He didn't seem to buy it, but she'd described the cars, and he recognized them himself in his rearview within a few minutes of leaving the subdivision. "Should I ditch them?" he asked. "Let McManus decide. I'll call him." Her cell phone wasn't really secure, but there was no choice. There was no answer on the emergency number. Robbie's car phone rang a minute later. McManus didn't even say good morning. "They're ours," he said. "We've been covering you since last night, just in case." Before he hung up, Jim told Even he wanted to see her once she got in. She came straight up from the garage. Jim greeted her from behind his desk and asked her to close the door. He drained the last from a Starbucks cup and took a long time to look her over. He was well-groomed, but there were little gray swells from sleeplessness beneath his eyes. He prepared a speech. The assumption from the start, he said, was that they were dealing with rough company. Undercover agents who'd been unmasked had had some heaping bad times, McManus said. Shot. Some UCAs had been tortured to find out what they knew. His tone remained unruffled, but he did not spare details graphic enough that for a moment it was almost as bad as if he'd laid those corpses on his desk. As McManus figured it, he said, she was entitled to get out now. "I'm a big girl," she answered. "You have to think about it. Don't just sing from the hymnal." She had thought about it, much of the night. "It's starting to get exciting," she said. "We might be able to do it without you." That was ridiculous. They both knew that. If she cut and ran now, she might as well wire Walter Western Union to tell him Carmody was right. She tried to be level and unflappable, like McManus, as she shook her head. "At 10, we met." Jim stood up in his white shirt and addressed the assemblage. Senate, Robbie, me, and the remaining UCAs. DC had punted. The decision whether to go on had to be made on the ground, where the operatives themselves had the best vantage to judge how close they were to blown. Even was willing to go forward, he said, but he urged everyone to take a second to reconsider. Around the table, no one moved. It wasn't clear to me whether Stan would have offered Robbie the same chance to opt out, but Favor and I had talked already, and he was convinced that, for the moment, Even was the only one in serious peril. Stan received the community resolve with a taut, buttoned-up smile and took over. To reinforce the team, he had decided to share news previously sequestered in the realm of need to know. Everyone had realized that Amari and his surveillance squad had tailed the targets after the drops. Both Walter and Skolnick, it developed, had visited with Kosick within a few hours after Robbie passed them money. And the surveillance hadn't terminated there. Amari and his watchers had been dutifully following Rollo when he bought a newspaper or blood sausage at the market or visited a currency exchange. As he approached the register, an agent would sidle close enough to catch a look at the bills Kosick was using to pay. Then, as soon as he was gone, another agent would make a purchase with something larger. The idea was to get Rollo's bill back as change, in the hope it would prove to be part of the pre-recorded money Robbie had delivered. And it had worked. They'd hit the bullseye 3 times now, picking up 2 bills Robbie had passed to Skulnick, from one of which D.C. had even lifted Rollo's prints. This morning at Paddywhack's, the notorious hang of Country Paul's, where Rollo, as always, had paid for Brendan's breakfast, Amari had recovered a 50 that Robbie had given Walter yesterday at 5 p.m. Stan was prepared to ask the chief judge to approve a bug in Kosick's office the next time money changed hands. "The game is changing," Stan said. "We're in the second half. After yesterday, we have to figure the clock is running. But folks," Stan's dark eyes were bright as a grackle's, "we're literally, literally right outside Brendan Toohey's door." Chapter 26. Since Sherm Crowthers treated all souls on Earth as likely enemies, he refused to employ the usual courthouse bagman. Instead, according to Robbie, Sherm did business through his half-sister, Judith McQueevy, the proprietor of a successful soul food restaurant in the North End. Judith had begun with a simple storefront and had expanded over the years. Although only the hardiest of white folk ventured into the neighborhood after dark, it was not unusual at lunch for all colors to gather there, drawn by the legendary fried chicken or the southern-style ribs, simmered until the meat parted from the bone. Robbie and Evan had arrived at noontime one day in late April. After their meal, Robbie approached Judith at the register. In paying the check, he handed over an envelope intended for her brother in gratitude for the fine settlement supposedly achieved after Crowthers manhandled McManus in the sexual harassment case of Olivia King. "Like me, Stan had known Sherman for years, although he had a far dimmer opinion of him as a result of tangling with him as an opponent. But with that advantage, Sennett had figured a way to trap Crowthers. Ordinarily, the envelope favor offered would have been almost an inch thick, containing $100 bills. Employing the familiar gambit, Sennett decided Robbie should short Crowthers, figuring in this case Sherman would confront favor rather than abide being dissed. "I gotta talk to him," Robbie had whispered to Judith amid the restaurant's luncheon clamor. The air was heavy with frying smells and the piquancy of greens. "There's something he doesn't understand." Judith, who was far too shrewd not to know what was occurring, steadfastly refused to acknowledge anything. She was a big person, taller than Robbie in her high heels, and clearly a fan of her own cooking. At noontime, she wore a snug, spangled evening gown, profuse purple eyeshadow, and a heavy Ghanaian necklace, apparently solid gold. When Robbie handed over the envelope, Judith, adroit in these matters, pouched out a heavy vermilion lip as she hefted the package. There was only $2,000 there. "Mm-hmm," she said to herself. "That's why I have to see him," Robbie whispered.
"I wouldn't know a thing about that," Judith said, a well-practiced line.
Her dangling earrings, little African gods, and her long straightened hair rambled about as she shook her head.
"Please," Robbie answered.
Usually he paid Judith $200 for lunch, declining the change as her tip. But today he peeled 500s off the roll in his pocket. Judith, a woman of prosperity, looked at the money through one eye. Her usual animation drained, and she cheated a glance at Evan, who stood a safe distance away, while she'd overheard their exchange on the infrared. The kitchen was just to the rear, and around them rattled the voices of waitresses in their pink uniforms, demanding their orders from the chefs in a characteristic tone of weary disappointment in the performance of men. One thing Judith had learned in this life was that money was money. You couldn't have too much. And she finally picked up the hundreds and crushed them in her fist. She waved Robbie on his way, even as he begged her for reassurance that she'd speak to her brother. Whatever she'd told Sherman, however, did not work. Crowthers made no effort to contact Robbie. Instead, the next time Favor appeared before Crowthers, in the first week in May, coming in with McManus on the case that had been transferred to Sherman's calendar from Jillian Sullivan's, the judge had scalded Robbie with a furious look. Without explanation, he granted McManus's standard motion to dismiss the suit.
"Figures," said Stan. "He's crunching your nuts because you didn't come through."
Sennett was probably right, although a defense lawyer would argue that the judge had just called this one as he saw it, much as he had in King. Besides, there was a more ominous explanation now for Sherman's conduct. They knew. If Walter gave credence to Carmody's suspicions and circulated the news, that might account for both Sherm's rage and his eagerness to rule against Favor. Either way, McManus and Sennett agreed that Robbie had to force a meeting with the judge. There was not much to lose. With the potential of suspicions arising about Even, there was less time for patience, and the case they had against Crowthers was too thin to prosecute. Judith was unlikely to flip on her brother, and Walter's stunts with Malatesta had emphasized the fallibility of treating a payoff to a bagman as proof of a judge's involvement. Amari's surveillance had never traced Robbie's money from Judith to the judge. They met, but nobody could ask a jury to draw a criminal inference from a get-together between siblings. On Thursday, May 6th, Robbie appeared in the small reception area of Crowther's chambers and asked to see him. Sherm's sheer size and his aggressive character presented a new risk. There was no telling exactly what he would do if he felt cornered or provoked. For that reason, Even, again equipped with the infrared earpiece, was lurking right outside the chamber's door. Stan and McManus and I were in the surveillance van, which was parked on Sentwick, one of the side streets bordering the courthouse. Amari's watchers had confirmed that Crowthers was in his chambers. After a long wait, during which Robbie entertained us with a softly whistled version of most of the score of Phantom of the Opera, Sherm's secretary announced the judge would see him. Sherman's firm basso cut off Favor's cheery greetings.
"What brings you here, Mr. Favor?"
Robbie seemed to hesitate.
"Judge, I guess this is a personal thing. I just..."
"Favor, I never meet lawyers alone. Seems to me you've been round this courthouse long enough to have heard that. I always ask Mrs. Hawkins to stay here, or to be sitting right outside the open door. Nothing personal, just good practice."
"Crap,"
mouthed Sennett from his fold-down seat across from me. Robbie, who'd never approached Crowthers directly, was clearly taken by surprise.
"Well, Judge, this is really awfully embarrassing this way."
"Nothing embarrassing about it. Just say your piece."
Inspired, McManus pulled his cell phone from his briefcase and dialed Crowthers' chambers. We could hear the phone pealing over the foxbite, but Mrs. Hawkins apparently was not about to move. Robbie, however, had had an inspiration of his own.
"Well, Judge, there was a young lady in my office this morning, Judge, and she wants to bring a paternity suit against Your Honor."
Mrs. Hawkins reacted first, a startled trill as if she'd been pinched.
"Paternity suit?" Crowthers thundered. "Who's this? Who in the hell is this female scalawag gonna try to shake some money out of my tree? No, wait, Mrs. Hawkins has no need to hear this. Wouldn't want to, I'm sure. You go on, Miss Hawkins. Not a word of truth in this, Mrs. Hawkins, I assure you. Mr. Favor and I are gonna get to the bottom of this thing right now."
The door closed soundly enough to suggest Mrs. Hawkins was miffed.
"Hey, Judge, I'm sorry about that."
Robbie's voice had grown smaller, and he was clearly moving closer to the heavy paper-strewn desk where Crowthers sat.
"I've been trying to get with you for weeks. I gotta explain. About King?"
he said, meaning the case about the ornery executive who'd harassed his former secretary. There was no response. Crowthers did not so much as clear his throat.
See, Judge, this is really embarrassing. I know you didn't see what you were expecting, but this chick, the plaintiff, Olivia, she didn't sign, Judge. I thought the paralegal had gotten her to do it. She thought I had. But bottom line, I don't have a fee agreement. And you know, Judge, she's an operator. Olivia, she knew what she was doing. She's already got another lawyer telling me he's going to bar admissions and discipline if I don't release the whole check to her. I mean, it's a pisser, Judge. I say implied contract. He says, okay, $300 an hour, send her a bill. Can you imagine, Judge? $500,000 settlement and she's looking for an hourly fee.
Nothing. As I imagined the scene, Crowthers, an immense presence, sat behind his large desk, his eyes and the huge whites turned upward to Robbie and almost throbbing with anger, his nostrils widened in a primal flare. Anyone's first instinct would be to cut and run, but Robbie kept scraping out his apology for shortchanging the judge.
If I get 5,000 out of the case, it's a lot. I mean, what can I do, Judge? That's why I was light with Judith. Between you and your sister, you figured taxes and expenses. You guys got everything on this one. The whole chili relleno.
Still, no sound. There was nothing, not even a grunt that might have passed for assent. Facing this recording, a defense lawyer was likely to maintain that the judge was no longer there, that Robbie was talking to himself as a desperate way to enhance the body count and improve his sentence. Beside me, McManus whispered,
"He's getting smoked."
Sennett nodded. Then it turned worse.
"What the hell is this?" Crowthers asked suddenly. "What kind of crazy shit are you talking? In my entire life, I have never heard such stupid, crazy shit."
Even Jim groaned on that one. As with Malatesta, Robbie's instructions were to cut it short if he began eliciting denials, and his clothing shifted roughly over the microphone as he started for the door.
"Right, Judge, you're right. I was just really stupid, I know that. I'll catch up next time. Scout's on her, and I'm going to tell her out there, Mrs. Hawkins. I'll tell her it's a mistake and all, that..."
"What?" At the edges, Robbie's voice raveled in alarm. A spring sang out. You could hear the chair rolling with velocity and a rocking sound as it hit the wall.
"What?" Robbie said. "There..."
The smack of flesh on flesh was distinct. I was certain Crowthers had slapped him. The mic jostled harshly as Robbie rocked, and he cried out simultaneously, but that was stifled quickly, even as Robbie tried to speak. Sherm had gotten hold of him, by the mouth or the throat. Doubled over, McManus scrambled up toward the front and told Amari to alert the covering units. In the meantime, from Favor's gargled sounds and the thumping of his boot heels, I decided he was being dragged along. A door slammed in an oddly resonant way. Then there was a whooshing sound, some kind of whispering in the background, almost like static.
"Who you?"
It was Crowthers in a harsh whisper, somewhat muffled by the persistent noise in the backdrop. "Water," said Amari in front, identifying the sound.
"Christ," said Stan. "He's got him in the john."
Jim had the cell phone out of his pocket. He was dialing a number, Evan's pager, I imagined, ready to signal her to go in. They had to be standing very close in the little bathroom that had joined Crowther's chambers. I'd seen the facilities in the temple on a number of occasions, and there was barely room for one person, especially somebody of Sherm's size.
"Listen here," the judge said. "I'm just standing here wondering who the hell you thinking you are. What I'm supposed to call you, Chatty Cathy? What the hell you doing, man? You know better than that. I don't want to be hearing about this crazy shit."
"Judge, I'm not trying to mess with you." It was a relief to hear Favor's voice. "I just wanted to be sure you're not creased."
"I'm creased, okay? Especially about the way you going on. Now cut that shit out." If I'm not satisfied with the way you attend to your business, you gon' know that. It seems to me you do. Am I right?
Yes, sir.
So next time you gon' attend to your business, right?
Yes, sir.
That's all. Just don't talk that crazy shit to me.
His voice dropped.
Get us both in a trick bag.
Sennett shot me a look marked by a fleeting grin.
Trick bag.
We both knew it was one of those lines that turn a case in front of a jury. Favor's shoes resounded on the tiles, but Crowther spoke up harshly.
Close that door. Did I say we're done?
No, Judge.
Then come here. Right here. Come right here. Now what you mean about my sister? Between me and my sister. What's that about?
Sir?
You heard me. Don't give me that dumb old fay look. I know better than that. What'd you give her?
Favor seemed dumbstruck by the implications. Crowthers repeated the question.
Five, Judge.
$5?
$500. $500 for her and $2,000 for you.
So she gets quarter what I get? And I'm the judge? Something ain't right about that.
Well, I told you, Your Honor. That was just so I could talk to you. Apologize. That came out of my own pocket.
Well, there any more in that pocket?
There was a discernible gurgle of surprise from Favor, but I thought he was in role.
You know, Judge, I mean, I've got an office. I've got overhead.
Aw, shit. Who you think you're talking to? You think I'm just some boy off a walnut plantation?
Oh, God, no, Judge.
Now you come round here, bother me like this. That